How you doing?
Fine, and you?
All right. Recovering from throwing a New Year's party.
Okay. I guess I wasn't invited.
Well, you were a couple times on his way, and I don't think we've ever actually met officially, so, you know, I didn't want to invite
everyone. Actually, maybe we shouldn't be doing this now, but I think we were at Stanford together, no?
We were at Stanford together?
Yeah, what years were you there?
I was there from 90 to 96.
Yeah, I was there from 91 to 93.
I didn't know that. What, you were in the journalism school? Or
no, I got my history PhD there.
I didn't know that. In 2 years? Yeah. That's very impressive.
Well, I did the coursework for, 3 or 4 semesters, and then I left and took my orals, and then I never went back.
Okay. I got it. That's good to know. Well, I did not know we overlapped there. That's interesting. And we would have been right next door to each other, because at that point...
Yeah.
Poli Sci was right next to history. They've since rescheduled. You know,
and I did all my reading on that bench outside the Hoover Institute.
Oh, yeah. That's a grand irony given your future trajectory.
Yeah.
But, yes. I can actually say I had lunch with Jennifer Connelly down in the Poli Sci Cafe there.
Yeah. I don't want to play county atop this, but she was my student.
Oh, there we go. All right. That's impressive. Good to know. All right. Well, why don't we get to the...
All right.
Issues at hand. Let's start with, you know, what the press has been covering about a lot. Gerald Ford died. I'm surprisingly, you know, not terribly moved by all of this sort of, you know, there seems to be this whole exercise in you know, eulogizing him. And it's not that I have anything horribly bad to say about him, but I'm just not terribly enthused either way. What are your thoughts?
I don't have any feelings at all about Gerald Ford, but what do you think it's all about, all this mawkishness?
I think part of it is, I mean, it is an exercise, you know. I mean, we saw this with Reagan, too, and I'm sure we'll see it with Carter if he were to die also. I mean, part of this is sort of a national ritual thing. I might also think this way because I just finally caught up and saw The Queen, the movie. Have you seen that yet?
Yeah, I thought it was pretty good.
Yeah, you know, and again, it was the same, you know, similar sort of thing, you know, the idea that this is sort of a national, you know, outpouring of relief. Although with Ford in particular, it's odd. I mean, he was, you know... It was not like he ever really held a mandate in any way, you know, not the same way that Reagan did or Carter or even Nixon, for that matter. The other thing, though, that might be fueling this is the fact that Ford gave a couple of interviews before he died, clearly where it wasn't to be released until after he died. There was the interview with Woodward, and then also I think he did one with Michael Beschloss in Newsweek.
Yeah.
Which makes me wonder, is this going to be, you know, standard operating procedure now for, you know, all sort of future presidents?
Yeah, I mean, what Ford was doing with those interviews was assuring himself a better place in history than he would have had because he had the judgment to oppose the war in Iraq.
Well, yeah, but the one he did with Beschloss was back in 95. So, I mean, it was, you know...
No, but I haven't read that one.
Right,
yet, but it's the same thing. In other words, he's worried about his place in history. He's not worried about whatever value his intervention might have in the present, which is, I think, kind of a selfish...
But that's the point. Isn't it such a blatantly transparent move that it actually, you know, it'll actually rebound back on him? I mean, you know, it seems obvious that he left these markers so that, you know, he could burnish his legacy. But in doing it so obviously, I think it actually detracts from it. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong about this. But, I mean...
History takes longer to reveal itself, so we can't really judge. But... You know, you couldn't have done much better than he did with all of the tributes, all of the David Broder-like, you know, outpourings of the great statesman and the healing guy and so forth.
Although, Jack, and, did you see...
I think it's all about the system. These guys are in love with the system. They don't care what the system produces, as long as the system works. And Ford was a man of the system. He bided his time. He was a minority leader for 100 years. You know, and he spared the country the ordeal of Nixon's trial, which I think was a mistake. But the point is that he operated, he made the system work in such a way that the people who write about it and who live inside it could feel good about it.
And that's
what they're, I think, giving tribute to. It doesn't matter. I mean, Ford, he didn't do a very good job in his presidency. He made a lot of very bad decisions. He was terrible on that North Korean thing. What was that boat?
The Pueblo, yeah,
and completely dishonest about it. You know, he was a small man who was a good minority leader from Grand Rapids, Michigan. He was competent at that. He was an accidental president.
Right.
He occupied the office without any great catastrophes. But that's all. And yet, the presidencies we've had before and since, if you include Nixon, but with the exception of George H.W. Bush, who I think will be similarly canonized when he dies, everybody else has created this trauma and has not sort of played the game the way that these guys want to play it. And I think really that's what this tribute is all about.
So that's an interesting possibility. I'm not sure if I would go quite into the systemic argument. It's more personal than that. You know, it's the natural thing of, you know, if someone gets to know, it's the sort of Sally Quinn, Ben Bradley thing, where these people are so plugged into each other, they're part of Washington society. I mean, maybe you can call that a system. I would consider it almost, you know,
I didn't say it, but that was implicit in what I meant by the system.
Oh, okay.
Part of the system is having dinner at Ben and Sally's and, you know, knowing how to do that.
Right, exactly. No, that might be a fair way of putting it. I mean, again, I don't really have anything horrible to say about him. I mean, I actually thought the best thing that was written about was Jack Schaefer had a funny piece in Slate where he pointed out that the key word that everyone was using to describe Ford was decent, which Schaefer interpreted as a euphemism for dull and not quite, you know, up to par. And I think that's probably a fair take on the whole thing.
I think that, you know, I don't know too much about Ford. I've kind of given myself a pass on all this. I saved all the material for a book I'm writing, but I haven't read any of it. Mm-hmm. But I do get the strong impression that Ford was really behind the times on much of the key civil rights legislation and sort of represented white reaction against civil rights rather than a more progressive view. And I haven't seen much mention of that.
Perhaps, although I would dissent, at least personally, I would dissent from that. I mean, my understanding is one of the anecdotes that was told at the memorial that I read about is that when Ford was a football player in Michigan, he refused to play at one point because they were going to play Georgia Tech, and the Michigan team was going to comply with Georgia Tech's segregation policies, and so a black player for the University of Michigan was not going to be allowed to play. He put it this way. Personally, he'd taken positions, you know, which suggested he was at least in some ways ahead of the curve at the time.
Yeah, but, I mean, like I said, I'm prefacing by saying I don't really know the details.
Yeah.
But guys are always being really nice personally and then being cowardly when it's necessary to show great public, you know, courage. So personally, you know, it doesn't bind me that much.
I can accept that. And again, I don't know the details of Ford's history as the minority leader during the 60s.
I had drinks at somebody's house the other day, and Rick Perlstein was there, who's been working for the past 5 or 6 years on a history of the Nixon era.
Mm-hmm.
And he was telling me about what a terrible record Ford had in this regard.
Ah.
Again, that's yours.
Okay. Well, why don't we, let's move on from Ford a little bit. Let me see. I saw your post today, you know, brilliantly highlighting all the predictions that you, you know, had made in 2006, but forgotten to post until this year.
Yeah. And lucky I found that.
I congratulate you on finding that. And, you know, just again, I'm astonished at some of the brilliant predictions you made on that. And it gave rise to something that I was thinking about, because I've seen this is a theme throughout your work. You know, back to like, you know, Sound and Fury, which I've read. You know, on when is it that pundits, you know, pay a price for making really bad predictions in the past? You know, you've harped on this, you know, whenever David Ignatius writes about Iran or Iraq, pointing out that Ignatius predicted that, you know, Iraq was going to be a success, and it clearly wasn't. You know, and I think in your previous debate with Matt Iglesias talked about the fact that, you know, a lot of people who are now talking about Iran really screwed up Iraq, and therefore, you know, do you get a... you know, do you therefore give him a pass with regard to Iran? I mean, let me ask you a more general question, which is, when is someone wrong enough so that you can finally write them off, discount them completely, or is it a case that if someone gets something wrong, but they get it wrong because they actually had the right thought process, you give them a pass? I mean, how in your mind
well,
should this
I
work?
Well, I think that's a fair question. I mean, when I make a big decision, I usually give myself a pass on whether or not the decision turns out to be right. Because
uh-huh.
You can't, there's a lot you can't know in life.
Right.
But I try to, I'm very hard on myself about the information I had at the time.
Right.
And I think that, you know, the main issue here, and I might be repeating myself from my conversation with Matt, is the fact that it's not really, these guys don't have their jobs because they're good pundits.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have their jobs because their prognostications are accurate or their data and evidence are solid. They have their jobs because they fulfill the in television, the entertainment dicta, and in print, they sort of fulfill the position. You have to be better in print than you have to be on TV in terms of getting things right. But they have a role to play, and they play it. When I first wrote Sound and Fury, which, thank you for mentioning it, you know, I compared, like, that was the, sort of the beginning of the McLaughlin Group, and I compared each one of these guys to their stock characters. And I remember Jack Tremblay was Fred Mertz, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And Mort Kondracki was the little boy with his hand up in the air while the teacher was talking, and then the teacher would call on him, and he would forget the question. Robert Novak, I don't know, he was kind of a more malevolent Eddie Haskell.
I think my favorite characterization of Novak, did you ever read Joe Bob Briggs's essay where he talked about the talk shows?
No.
Oh, he wants to, you know, he described Novak as the only person who could ever file an IRS return with the, listing under occupation obnoxious.
In any case, you know, Novak, when he cursed on CNN and threw his little fit,
right?
He was showing you what it takes to lose your job on one of these shows.
Mm-hmm.
But barring that, the fact that, you know, what he did, I think, was disloyal to the country, barely an eyebrow was raised. And the spectacularly wrong predictions, I mean, Ignatius is bad, but by far the worst predictor, I think, is William Crystal.
Mm-hmm.
Who said that this war would not only be a piece of cake, but it would set off a democratic revolution throughout the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, you know, I got to tell you, I don't mind people who are wrong so much as people who attempt to undermine the intelligence and patriotism of people who disagree with them, like Crystal mm-hmm. has done frequently, like Andrew Sullivan did repeatedly after 9/11. And that's what I object to most vehemently, because there were people like, if you leave me out of it, people like Anthony Zinni, people like Jim Fallows, people like Walter Pincus. There was very good reporting in the New Republic by John Judis and Spencer Ackerman, where you could find all kinds of questions that people just didn't want to address themselves because they had made up their mind to go to war no matter what.
Right, Cox News Service also.
Excuse me?
I think it was Cox News Service also did...
No, it was... not Cox, it was... Knight Ritter.
Thank you. Yes, it was Knight Ritter.
Knight Ritter did it perfectly. And there were others as well, and yet these people had to defend their patriotism. You know, there was a Bill O'Reilly had mugshots up of them. Both the New Republic and the Weekly Standard had idiot reports or whatever they called them, mm-hmm. as did Andrew, idiot awards or something.
Mm-hmm.
And the only crime of these people is that they had a different analysis. And that's what I object to so vehemently. So, you know, it's okay to be wrong if you're honest about what your data is. You say, look, here's what I know, and here's what I think. I was spectacularly wrong about one of the most important things in the world I wrote about yesterday, which was the fact that John Kerry would be the best candidate.
Right. Well, you weren't alone in that.
That was just stupid.
Yes.
I know I wasn't alone. But this is what I'm supposed to know.
Right. Exactly.
I was wrong in my very area of presumed competence. And I was profoundly wrong, and whoever listened to me helped drive the country into George Bush's hands, which is the worst imaginable sin in my life. You know, and it was terrible, but I think I was honestly wrong. And I didn't say, if you disagree with me, you're a bad person.
Mm-hmm.
But that's I think, what the modus operandi of many of these guys is,
right.
is that they're so into the personalities they've created that they don't have any sense that many of these questions are complicated and difficult, and it's very easy to disagree on.
To push you on Sullivan for a second, because, I mean, he's clearly issued a fair number of mea culpas about Iraq, you know, and that he got stuff wrong. I mean, do you think that's sufficient, or, you know, you'll never forgive him for his behavior during the fall of 2001?
Well, I won't forgive him even for his mea culpas. What he said in his the mea culpa that I read
mm-hmm.
was, okay, I was wrong when I said that you couldn't trust the decadent bourgeois elites in New York and on the other coast,
mm.
which was an amazing statement when you think about a gay man talking about decadent elites, because that's exactly the phrase that was used about gays.
Mm-hmm.
He said, but these people were, you have to admit, they were objectively pro-Osama, or pro-Sodom. He's saying we were objectively pro-Sodom because we didn't think it was in the interest of the United States to take out this dictator.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean we like the dictator.
That means we
recognize that the world is more complicated. We just can't go around the world taking out every dictator. we're no more objectively pro-Sodom than Andrew is objectively pro whoever the hell is committing the genocide in Darfur. Mm-hmm. You know? But again, Andrew has, he's done half of the job, which is the easy half, which is to say I was wrong about Iraq, I agreed about the WMD, and I got caught up in the moment. But he hasn't dealt with the really difficult part, nor has William Crystal, who hasn't even admitted to being wrong on Iraq. You know, William Crystal wrote the most amazing column. I did an event with him, and I'm so mad at myself, because we spent about an hour in the green room, and I forgot to ask him. But he wrote the most amazing column during the Democratic primaries in 2003, where he echoed a famous column of his father's that had appeared in commentary in 1952. Mm-hmm. His father said, and I'm paraphrasing, but his father said, there's one thing that Americans know about Joe McCarthy, and that is he is unalterably opposed to communism. Of American liberals, they know no such thing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that's always been a very sort of infamous statement by Irving Kristol.
Yeah.
So William Kristol writes the very same sentence about Richard Gebhardt in substituting the word terrorism for communism. And I can't, for the life of me, figure out why he would want to relive this moment of McCarthyizing liberals, mm-hmm. the same way his father did on behalf of McCarthy. To why he would want to associate himself with that kind of thing. But, and that's, you know, a question for a psychologist, not a political analyst.
Right.
But there are any number of instances where Kristol, where Sullivan, where most of the people on the staff of the Weekly Standard, and where members of the Bush administration have said, you know, it's not that we disagree, it's that I love America and my opponent doesn't. And this is poison in our political discourse.
It is poison. Can I ask you a question? Isn't it also, I mean, it's poison that in the end has killed them just as much as it's killed their, you know, opponents. I mean, there's no question that this kind of rhetoric had an effect, you know, to some extent, you know, certainly in the first term of the Bush administration between 9/11 and let's say, 2004. But do you think that it's still, I mean, that, you know, there is a learning effect, I would have to think. And I don't think it's working in the same way. I mean, take the New York Times story yesterday, the one where Bush says he doesn't want to say, you know, that he can't talk, he has to talk about victory. That he doesn't want to stop talking about victory in terms of Iraq, even though it's obvious to pretty much everyone that we're never going to have anything approximating victory in Iraq. But he's trapped in he's almost trapped by his own rhetoric. It's blowback. It's a blowback problem. And as a result, he looks more and more foolish.
He does, but he's still the president.
He's still the president, yes.
He's still the president, and the punditocracy, the very same people who have done this, have retained their positions in the punditocracy or been promoted. I mean, Sullivan and Kristol are now two-fifths of Time magazine's contributors, joined by Charles Krauthammer and Joe Klein, who does a lot of this same kind of thing. There's no price to be paid for attacking the left in this as unpatriotic. As weird as it is, it's a big problem for me because to explain it, because it's complicated and it takes a lot of time and space. But, you know, yes, there are aspects of the media that make them liberal, but there's this sort of pass that people get for attributing the worst imaginable
intentions
to liberals. I mean, Thomas Friedman, who's not even considered a conservative, wrote a column saying liberals want us to lose in Iraq. He didn't present a single shred of evidence. So did another columnist who works for the New York Times via the International Health Review, Roger Cohen. He wrote it this week. I'm really going to deal with it in my Nation column, where he said the left, you know, the left doesn't see any difference between the United States and Sodom. Christopher Hitchens this week said that, you know, there's an equation on the left between the Taliban and the United States. These are all ways of saying we don't love our country. It's not even Hitchens' country. It's not even Sodom's country. It's just amazing to me that what you can get away with on the left. The reason I think for
Eric, wait a minute. The Taliban does trigger something in me. I mean, there have been people on the left who have used the rhetoric describing the Republican right as like the Taliban. Correct me if I'm wrong.
I've done it myself.
Yeah.
The Taliban wing of the Republican
right.
Party. But we're kidding.
Oh, okay. So it's a question of humor.
It's tongue-in-cheek.
All right.
Maybe the problem is just these guys don't have a sense of humor.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's one of those things where the joke is too soon. I mean, look, agree.
And by the way, we don't do that so much since 9/11.
Yeah.
It was a lot more frequent before.
Yeah, no, that's a fair point. I mean, the thing I would say about this, I don't want to be in a situation to completely defend Sullivan and Crystal for getting a lot of things wrong. On the other hand, I mean, I'm not sure you've read there was a book last year that I was very enthusiastic about that Philip Tetlock wrote called Explaining Political Judgment, where Tetlock has, you know, for the past 15 years polled not commentators so much, but like actual, you know, academic experts, you know, at least in theory, you know, scholars about international relations or a particular area or so on and so forth, you know, constantly asking them to predict what's going to happen in the future. And the amazing thing is how bad and how wrong most of these predictions are. That basically a monkey with a dart could do a better job than most, than most experts.
I think that maybe you wrote about this, and I read it, because I haven't read the book, but I've heard this argument.
Right. No, it was written, Louis Menon wrote a review of it in the New Yorker last year.
Oh, yeah, I read that,
And I, you know, as I said, I've read the book, or a lot of the book, and I mean, it's a very good book, and it's a very sobering book for someone, you know, like me as a political scientist that likes to think that, you know, if you're trained a certain way, you at least have a slightly better grasp on the future. But, you know, not so much. So, I mean, part of the problem might be that even if these guys aren't doing their job terribly well, it's not clear to me that anyone can do this job terribly well.
Well, you know, I tend to agree with that, which is why I consider myself as much a realist as a liberal in foreign policy.
Mm-hmm.
By which I mean, I don't think we should try and do too much. I don't think we're capable of doing too much. If you know, things go wrong. We don't understand other cultures. You can't predict what will happen as a result of your interventions. Mm-hmm. And you can't plan for them. And you can't depend on having the resources of the United States people at your disposal indefinitely.
All right, then wait. I wanted to ask you something about this, because this actually calls to mind. There's something that Foreign Policy Magazine just posted today. It's an article by Dan Kahneman and Jonathan Renshin that argues that we've got this sort of, that human beings are hardwired to prefer hawkish policies as opposed to dovish policies. You know, in terms of doing things like fundamental attribution error, assuming that the others act with malice as opposed to potentially unintentionally or for, you know, because of the environment or because we're excessively optimistic about, you know, the way in which we control our own fate, these kinds of things. I got a long post, you know, dealing with those kinds of issues about foreign policy, but the thing that struck me reading that was, you know, and as you were talking about, you know, in terms of foreign policy, you want to make, you're now almost, you know, sympathetic to realism. I think a lot of the left has become more sympathetic with realism because it, you know, advises a more prudent policy. But to what extent can that kind of, all these sorts of flaws then be applied to domestic policy? In other words, I mean, I know, Eric, you're a big enthusiast for, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, universal health care, single-payer system. That's a massive undertaking. Why wouldn't the skepticism that you got about, you know, foreign policy not be applied to grand domestic initiatives as well?
I wouldn't say I'm a big enthusiast.
Okay.
And in fact, I'm reasonably conservative when it comes to large initiatives in domestic policy too.
But would you agree that, like, you know, at least it would be fair to say that the left has a fair number of grand initiatives?
I would say that the left has gotten an awful lot more conservative over the past 20 years, in part because they feel that they're more difficult to sell them to the country, but in part because they've gotten more respect for the difficulty of carrying these things out. I think the reaction to all of the, I mean, I think the reaction to sort of Brown v. Board and the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act have really chastened people. I mean, there's been so much, you know, we just figured there was a sort of we shall overcome period of American history
mm-hmm.
where we just had to educate the racists to love their brother and give the poor little black and brown children a chance to have the same opportunities as white children. And everything would be fine. And in fact, you know, we've basically had a race war in this country, a low-level race war for the past 60 years that sometimes has broken out into violence and other times has been conducted nonviolently. But, you know, in many ways, our race problem is as bad as it was 40 or 50 years ago. Certainly,
wait a minute. Do you really think that, Eric? I mean, that's
well,
a hell of a
you
strong
know, again, plan. you have to qualify these things.
Yeah.
I think we have a black middle class, which we didn't have back then.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that in creating this black middle class and creating opportunities for them, we've destroyed, and this is William Julius Wilson's argument,
mm-hmm.
we've destroyed the foundation of life in the ghetto. And so that the black underclass is far worse off than it was back then. And affirmative action programs don't touch these people at all.
Right.
You know, in the 146 top universities in America, I've just been writing about this for this book I'm writing,
mm-hmm.
Only 3% of students come from the poorest quartile
right.
of the country, in which black people are disproportionately mm-hmm. part. So, so in many ways, if you were born in Watts today or in parts of the Bronx, your life would be a lot less personally satisfying to you than it would have been in 1950, when that was a genuine functioning community with economic opportunity and professionals and clergy and black doctors and lawyers and so forth who lived among you. Now, I'm not saying that that world is better than this world, but what I'm saying is that there were all. The only point I'm making here mm-hmm. is that there were all these enormously unintended and damaging consequences.
Right. There were. However well-intentioned desegregation yeah. was intended.
And so I think it's made liberals a great deal more conservative about trying these things. I mean, you know, there's just no political support in this country anymore for a race-based affirmative action. If you look at the example of Michigan in the last election that Richard Cullenberg has been writing about a lot, It had the support that that affirmative action law had the support of every single major establishment category in the state, including the Republican and Democratic candidates
mm-hmm.
for office, and it had big business support and it had union support, and yet it was overwhelmingly rejected
mm-hmm.
by the very same electorate that elected a lot of liberals to office,
right.
You know, including the governor. So there's just no support for that kind of thing in this country anymore. And liberals have to come to terms with the fact that Americans are up for some things and they're not up for other things as much as we would like them to be. And no matter how much we educate them to be up for the things we'd like them to be, it's not going to happen. So I think that we've learned that lesson. And I think that you're always going to find a few holdovers, you know, who represent very particular constituencies. But I think the leaders of American liberalism are a pretty pragmatic bunch, both in foreign and domestic policy. Their problem is that they don't know how to articulate their principles. Nobody knew what the hell John Kerry stands for, and it's hard.
I still don't know what John Kerry stands for, to tell you the truth. Yeah.
And it's true. When Al Gore ran in 2004, nobody knew what he stood for either. And if you ask me what I stand for in foreign policy, I'd have a hard time telling you. So the difficulty that liberals have, I think the Republicans, I think the conservatives, have by and large discredited themselves
mm-hmm.
Because they became incredibly extremist at the same time they became incredibly corrupt.
Mm-hmm.
And so they, you know, if a Republican wins, it's not going to be a Republican in the mold of Bush.
No, I agree. I mean, this actually goes to the question I think you wanted to talk about, the point about grand strategy. You know,
yeah.
Where do we go from...
Why don't you recap that fine article you wrote?
The Washington Post piece, yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It was basically sort of a review of, you know, it was an acknowledgement of the fact that, look, clearly Bush's grand strategy has not really worked. You know, it's articulated in the forms of, you know, neoconservatism, you know, doctrine of preemption, the notion that, you know, we'll engage in forceful regime change, and that will lead to democracy, and that will, you know, drain the swamp of terror. Therefore, we're casting about for a new grand strategy. But just because the old one's been discredited doesn't mean you're going to see a new one for a couple reasons. The obvious one is that George W. Bush is still president for 2 years. But more importantly, you need a logical alternative that is attractive and that actually deals with, current difficulties. And so the Post piece sort of reviewed a lot of them, ethical realism, which Anatole Levin and John Hulsman put forward, the Princeton Project on National Security Strategy, which is sort of, you know, deals with multiple threats. Francis Fukuyama's strategy, which is sort of multilateralism, which is more of a process really than a strategy. And then Michael Mandelbaum's sort of, you know, America unlimited hegemony. And actually, Eric, this is a good point. I would like to, you know, officially apologize to all of those people whose grand strategies did not make it into the Post piece. Thank you. I got your emails.
Mm-hmm.
I apologize, you know, there was limited space. I only had, you know, 1,750 words. Bob Wright, this includes you. You didn't email me. You were classy, but I'm sorry. I actually had a paragraph on your...
Bob's is actually one of the best.
I had progressive realism in there, but it got cut. So I just want to apologize to everyone, because there were a lot of other grand strategies that I didn't get to. Maybe I'll write a more ambitious piece later on that, but don't send me any more emails on this.
Well, as I recall, of the ones you covered, I assume you covered the, you chose the ones that you thought were the strongest.
I chose the ones that I thought were, you know, I also did, to be honest, chose the ones that were more recent, you know, because obviously it was for the Washington Post.
Yeah.
But yeah, and I chose the ones that I thought made the biggest splash in terms of, you know, when they came out and, you know, developed some conversation. Yes.
Of my recollection of your piece, it was the ethical realism.
I said that by a nose I thought ethical realism would work, mostly because the other strategies that were out there, you know, Mandelbaum's, the Princeton projects for that matter, and Fukuyama's, all envisioned a much more ambitious U.S. foreign policy, and I don't think the public's in the mood for that right now. Whereas the advantage of ethical realism is that, you know, it basically advises the U.S. to retrench a little bit, to get off the Korean Peninsula, to, you know, stop irritating other great powers. And that's, you know, I think consistent with the mood of the country right now.
You know, I wrote a book that very, very, very few people ever read about
And I'm sorry I did not include it in this piece.
Yeah, no, about democracy and foreign policy that was published in 1998. Uh-huh. I think, called Who Speaks for America. It didn't even have a paperback printing, and the hardcover printing by Cornell University Press was under 3,000, so nobody read it. But one thing that I found to be consistent in studying this issue for three or four years that I wrote the book was that there's always been a disjunction between elite views and mass views of foreign policy.
Right. This is the other book that I did talk about in the post piece that I highly recommend. Ben Page and Marshall Bouton, called The Foreign Policy Disconnect, which took a look at survey evidence from the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations data for the past 25 years. And it is quite painstaking in talking about the gap between leaders
I
and the public.
I did that, too. They really should have footnoted me, because I footnoted the hell out of Ben Page's earlier book.
Well, you know, you can sue them. I mean, you know.
But for that reason, I'm not even going to mention them.
There you go. Okay.
In any case, for instance, The interesting issue for me was always how do you get the views of the masses to matter, because foreign policy is generally an elite preoccupation.
Right.
And it matters. Masses can only, you know, you can't have a mass-based foreign policy. You can't have elections about whether, you know, what to do with a treaty or a war or something. So how does the mass make its feelings known? Well, it can only do so in very gross ways, and those ways end up being viewed as tainted by racism or ethnocentrism and so forth, or what's called isolationism, although that's oftentimes a false nomer.
Yeah.
But I find this, we have an interesting case now that, you know, every Democrat who got elected is a much tougher on trade than his opponent.
Yes, that's a safe statement.
And
tougher, you mean, more protectionist. There's no other word for it.
Well,
yeah.
You could call it protectionist.
Yeah.
More fair trade oriented than free trade.
Fair enough. Yes.
And Sherrod Brown, who just murdered his opponent, you know, wasn't even close
right.
in Ohio,
mm-hmm.
which is the key state of this country.
Yeah.
Right now, Ohio, Florida, Pennsylvania.
Mike DeWine, who had very high personal ratings. I mean, no one really had much anything against DeWine.
He won on this issue.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree.
And yet, aside from crazy Lou Dobbs, there's no representation of this view in the punditocracy. It's considered crazy. It's even considered crazy by the liberals and people who write Democrats. I remember.
Hold on. Pat Buchanan certainly falls under this category.
I know, but it's only crazy people.
Stephen Pearlstein also, you know, hold this, and Harold Meyerson to a lesser extent?
Harold is it?
Yeah.
Harold alone. But you know, I found this column. I'm writing this book on liberalism now, and I'm mm-hmm. you know, it's a complaining about the way liberals are treated everywhere. And there was a column where Nicholas Kristof, during the 2004 election, Nicholas Kristof, who calls himself a liberal,
right.
He complained that on the one hand, Republicans, the Swift voters, were lying about John Kerry's record, and that was bad.
Right.
But on the other hand, Kerry refused to embrace free trade the way he should. In other words, he had an intellectual difference with Kerry, and it's actually a difference with the side that's supposed to be his side.
Yeah.
And he compared that to the intellectual dishonesty of the Swift voters. Tom Friedman does this all the time. The view within the punditocracy is that it's intellectually dishonest to question this free trade regime.
Mm-hmm.
And yet this is a majority view in the American people, and always has been. If you look at the
No, it's been consistent.
Look at the Chicago
I've got, I've written at length, I mean, I wrote about this for my Council on Foreign Relations book, and I've got another article that, I've actually got something coming out in the National Interest.
Did you write that history of the Council on Foreign Relations?
The history of the Council on Foreign Relations? No. I wrote a book that the Council on Foreign Relations published called U.S. Trade Strategy that talks about the public opinion mood. I had a piece in the American Interest last year about this as well, about the fact that the polls show unremitting hostility to free trade.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny. I'm not that – I'm pretty unsympathetic to free trade. I read the same book that Pat Buchanan read by it was an economic history of the country. I can't remember the author now, but he read it right before the New Hampshire primary when he did really well.
92, yeah.
Yeah, and I found it very compelling that if you look at the years historically, that the United States actually grew incredibly well under protectionism.
That's correlation, not causation. I mean, I'm not terribly.
No, I know, but the other argument is also correlation without causation. I debated when I published this book, Who Speaks for America. I debated Fareed Zakaria.
Yeah.
He was good enough to debate me on my book. And he said, how can you argue with free trade? It's given us the most successful, prosperous outcome imaginable.
Yep.
But again, there's no necessary correlation between those.
Well, I would disagree. I mean, look, there's a lot of studies I can cite you if you want. I mean, the Institute for International Economics, I think, had a great book out 2 years ago, which I cited, you know, that sort of actually did a very detailed methodology to try to chronicle exactly the benefits of the trade.
Yeah, I'm going to have to try and remember the name. I could go into my library and pull out this book. But in any case, we're not going to solve that one.
I agree. Okay.
But I think we
do agree, though, that if you poll Americans, you're right in that free trade, to some extent, is an undemocratic foreign policy in the sense that it doesn't mesh necessarily well with what
right.
the mood of the country is.
And there's quite a few of those kinds of issues.
Yeah, okay.
That's the most illustrative one.
Right.
So the question is how do you have a free trade, how do you have a foreign policy that you think will be an effective foreign policy that is also consistent with how you talk about foreign policy in the domestic arena? And it's very, very difficult.
It's difficult if
you believe in free trade, and it's difficult if you don't believe in killing people.
Well, I would say a few things. First of all, I mean, one of the things that I was struck by when I actually reviewed a lot of these grand strategy books is the extent to which trade is a vital component for them of grand strategy, which is part of the problem, I think, is that a lot of the critiques about trade, you know, when we talk about trade domestically, and you're right, there's not a lot of, you know, sympathy for the fair trade position, but all these people are talking about in terms strictly of economic effects. But the fact is, one of the biggest boons for a lot of grand strategists is the political effects that trade liberalization has in terms of, by keeping our market open, it presumably, you know, generates goodwill, not to mention economic growth in other countries. And what's interesting is that pretty much across the political spectrum, with the exception of, you know, sort of either extreme left or extreme right, there is an enthusiasm for trade expansion as one of the primary pillars, commercial diplomacy was one of the primary pillars of any grand strategy out there. And yet I think one of the problems is that trade is not actually sold domestically, you know, as a political argument. I mean, this goes back to, you know, even something like NAFTA, for example. I mean, Paul Krugman, who's, you know, been somewhat critical about the economic effects of NAFTA, wrote a great piece in Foreign Affairs in 94 saying, look, the reason we're doing NAFTA is not because of the economics of it, because of the politics. We want a stable Mexico. And this sort of locks Mexico into a certain set of reforms. And even Joe Stiglitz, who's hardly an enthusiast about free trade at this point, you know, I debated him about this at one point, and Stiglitz said when he was head of the Council of Economic Advisors, they recommended NAFTA because of the political effects. So I think part of the problem is trade is not debated in this country, in an honest way, I think on both sides. I think you're right. It would be nice to see more fair trade voices, you know, because that is resonant with the public mood. But I also think that you can make a compelling argument for free trade, not just based on the economics, but based on the politics.
Right. Well, I think the free trade argument is a lot like the foreign and military policy argument, which is if you don't embrace the consensus view, you're A, an isolationist, B, you're looking backwards, C, you're afraid to compete. It's never made on the merits. I agree. There's a case to be made on the merits.
Mm.
But the elite consensus makes people lazy on this. And again, so much of our debate is at the level of invective. Now, maybe some people might think I'm guilty of that myself.
Yeah.
But,
go ahead.
You know, that's because I'm tired of taking it.
Yeah. Okay, well, I'm trying to think if there's anything else. Oh, you wanted to talk about Israel and the Israel lobby and Carter.
Yeah, I don't know. You think we need to do that?
I have to say I've made it a professional policy not to try to get drawn into the Middle East.
Yeah, no,
so
it's late. We need a lot of time.
Yeah, I agree. So maybe we can do that next
40
time.
Minutes. 40 minutes is good.
I think so. Yeah. All right. Well, this was a very enjoyable, Eric. Hope to talk again.
See you soon. Bye.
All right, bye.